Hi, I'm John.
Hi, I'm Olivia.
And I'm Una.
And this week, we're going to talk about our man Bashir and argue about whether it's going to make us quit Star Trek.
This, I think my favourite part of this episode, my favourite fact about this episode, is that every moment of peace Julian tries to have, Garak ruins. And I think that's beautiful.
I think that is the epitome of their relationship. That is what it is about.
That's Garak. The whole thing, isn't it? Yeah, he's seen her having a cup of tea in Pat's prologue, and it just goes downhill for the next 7 years.
I mean, you know, you've contributed greatly to that in the Star Trek lore, haven't you? And I think we're all very grateful for that.
I've tried my best. There is so much more I could be doing, but
you know what Berwyn refused to give us, you gave it all to us.
I'd happily give more.
And I mean, it's, you know, you've got. I'm not going to, you know, I'd have a little bit of a fanboy. You've got an amazing crit. Honestly, you know, I'm listening to Last Best Hope right now on Audible, and you're amazing.
Please continue.
And you know, your audio, your biography of Janeway is getting read out by Kate Mulgrew.
Kate Mulgrew,
which is amazing,
isn't it? Just yeah,
you know, fundamentally, I don't think there's anything more you could want apart from, you know, being given your own Trek show to write.
That would be nice. Having a character, having a character named after me, that was pretty awesome too. That was a high point. Round about now, you saying those lovely things is when I have stopped quitting Star Trek.
But where did you start on this? Did you know?
Oh, where did I
start this journey?
Definitely watching the movies, because it was because I'm so very old. I was watching telly in Britain in the 70s, and it was a bit patchy where you could watch Star Trek. So it was the movies. It was going to, I saw Star Wars when I was eight. No, it wasn't that old. 1978, wasn't it? I was six. So I saw Star Wars. And then after that, I loved spaceships in the cinema. So I went to as many of the Star Trek movies that I could. So I suspect it was Wrath of Khan in the cinema. And then I was 16 when Next Gen arrived, and it started arriving on Blockbuster Video. And I was in the sixth form every Friday night while all my friends were clubbing. I would go to Blockbuster Video and get two cassettes.
Beautiful.
I would do that for Garak. I'm not sure I'd do that for TNG.
Do you know, it was worse than that. It was for episodes like Code of Honor. So
Code of Honor.
That's how desperate we were for anything good. So
imagine like spending money, serious money on Code of Honor.
Oh, well, at least I hadn't bought it, because I mean, you'd have been looking at 30 quid a pop for two episodes then. So this is just rental. Yeah. But that was, everyone else was clubbing at Jester's, and I was rewatching Encounter at Farpoint. So, but who's laughing now, kids?
Look who's laughing now. I am Star Trek.
Exactly. Was there a point? Just fulfilled and happy.
Excellent. Was there a point back then where you pulled, you know, you went to Blockbuster, you took your cassette, you stuck it in the, I don't know how old technology works, and you looked at Star Trek and went, this is dumb. Why don't I pay for this?
So I remember the occasion when I got the tapes, and there I was pedaling away to make the tape machine go around. And it was actually, and this will come back to bite me, I think it was something like A Man Alone in Deep Space Nine. And my other half and I, we were together by then after we flamed each other on a Doctor Who bulletin board. That's how we got together. Another story.
That's beautiful.
Pre-World Wide Web. He and I looked at each other and we went, this is not for us. And we bailed on Deep Space Nine.
Oh my God.
Bailed on Deep Space Nine and pledged allegiance to Babylon 5. And
okay,
that.
I can
the ultimate
that.
Betrayal.
I know. Well,
John's justifying it. I can see it in his eyes.
I get it. Actually,
I know. Look at that.
I mean, season one of Babylon 5 is better than season one of DS9.
Do you know, I thought that at the time, and I'm not sure I would agree now, but I have been quite Stockholm syndromed by DS9 since. Yeah.
I think DS9 is better writing because it was more seat of the pants. I think Babylon 5 has any advantage that Straczynski wrote the whole plot at once, which DS9 didn't have the advantage of. So, it's, you know.
I've not watched Babylon 5 since I've not watched it since the last anniversary, so it's probably about 7 years ago now. I suspect it doesn't look great now.
Oh, it doesn't. It really doesn't.
Yeah.
In lockdown, I watched it all on my phone, and then at home, I watched it all on the big HDTV my parents got, and it's just like, oh my God.
I'm excited. This is something that's still to come for me, like many things in sci-fi.
You've not seen it.
I will.
Oh, my God, I am there for your Twitter accounts when you start watching it. That will just be absolutely amazing because it is.
I can't wait for Olivia to meet Jakar, honestly.
Oh, yeah.
Who do you both predict that I will like be in love with? Who will be my Garrick?
Jakar.
Ivanova, actually.
Or Londo.
No, because, well...
I'm trying to memorise his names. So I can.
I feel like Olivia won't like Claude, though.
Well, the man of the moment, it could be Veer, I guess.
It could be Veer, yeah. I love Veer.
We're cast. Just rattling up. I mean,
the entire cast.
Then it's verbal snurge that she'll...
I think we're going to have a Babylon 5 special episode at some point.
Yeah.
But I think we shouldn't get distracted because we're missing...
Not Babylon 5. We are here. Oh, yeah, there is that other show on the space station.
Yeah, the other thing. The one with the Bonds thing. And, oh my God, this is... I forgot how beautiful this episode was. Beautiful it was.
Yeah.
It's extremely beautiful. This is not an episode that would make you quit Star Trek. If you quit Star Trek... after watching this episode, then I'm afraid Star Trek quits you. It just, you know, you are without soul, you are without joy, you are beyond the pale. It's just, it's just brilliant. Isn't
it? I feel like the only people who quit because of this episode were UBM, and that was for copyright infringement.
It's a little close, isn't it? It's just a little bit close there, I think.
Gosh, I'm just imagining the veracity with which I would defend Star Trek in a copyright. I was like, it's transformative. They have changed the game.
He literally says Bashir, Julian Bashir.
Yeah, but you know, he put his own twist on that. I mean,
and then you've even got the sort of John Barry stings as well in the background.
Oh my God, the John Barry stings.
Okay, it's all very beautiful. Yeah.
Let's get going because
We need to talk about what is the greatest opening sequence of all time.
It is, which is cock-blocking Garrick.
But it's this, it's the moment when he sees his opponent in the champagne bottle, is it?
Yeah.
And then shoots it at him.
Yeah.
To take him down.
Yeah. Now, I was very good. I did go and do some research this episode. Not only did I rewatch it, I got down off the shelf my Deep Space Nine companion, which I haven't had down for a long time. And I even found the receipt at the back. I bought it in September 2000. So I went and read. I went and read up the entry. And there are bits in it about the champagne cork, how it's somebody throwing it onto his head off camera. So it's all really high tech. I mean, you do it with CGI now, wouldn't you? You just CGI it. And then the reflection, obviously, they're not of the... Falcon, as they say in the bottle, that's not CGI, that's with a plate and stuff.
My favorite part of the champagne bottle is that it's obviously just being like put on a box or something. It's far too still,
and a man throwing a cork at it. Television is absolutely beautiful. So it's not Chateau Picard, is it?
That's a shame,
we've not invented that yet, so that would be pretty perfect.
But then we get Garrick just being like, what is this program? Is this your fantasy program? Julian, are you using the holo program to have sex without me?
And Julian's just like, go away. Motivated by blatant jealousy, I just love. It's like, you're not spending enough time with me, so this is a problem, and I'm going to interrupt.
And then Julian's like, fine, you can come. And then Garrick says...
Imagine Garrick sitting in the replomat, looking at his watch, going... We were meant to be, you know, this is three times this week. I know it was only an informal arrangement. I've read all the way through Dostoevsky for this meeting. And you're not even doing a Le Carré, you're doing a Fleming. And that's just unforgivable. So And he's not even in there with O'Brien. I mean, you know, if even if he was playing away with O'Brien, you know, obviously be furious about that. It's with some holographic floozy.
And then Garrett, Bashir is like, fine, you can come. And then he's like, what could possibly go wrong? And it's like, oh boy, here we go.
One of those on-the-nose Star Trek comments before everything goes wrong.
I mean, this whole episode is leaning on how on-the-nose it is. I mean, they go full Bond. Like, the valet is called Mona Loves It, which...
Well, Anastasia, come on and off, I think.
The accents in this episode are just... brilliant.
I mean, nothing is as good as how completely furious Garak is when Julia's like, oh, my character's a spy. And he's just like, I think I joined the wrong intelligence service.
Yes. The whole thing is just a massive troll of Garak. It really, really is, which is charming in its own right, I think. But Nana Visitor has my favourite moment in this entire, and there are many, many, many favourite moments in this. But her leaning back behind the headboard to pull that file out is...
Oh, it's like, I know, I wish I could relax you.
You know, but here we are, some work.
But I'm here on business.
And she doesn't get credit, Nana. She's a brilliant comic actor, I think. They're all, they're all great in this, just from start to finish.
I do think actually, as Kira, she does have very good comedic timing.
Yeah. Kira doesn't get to have a lot of laughs, I think. No. But Anastasia, come on and off. Certainly.
I mean, this is also an Eddington episode. And like, I mean, I have a very, I think, a popular take that I think Eddington deserves more character development before he then became evil. He's just kind of here.
Yeah.
And he's just kind of like
evil? Do you think Eddington's evil?
Well, I think before he becomes part of the Marquis. Less than evil.
I mean, in retrospect, I didn't notice him that much. Like, I knew of him, but then when I was going back to listen to this, I only remembered him as that traitor.
Oh, right, okay. Well, you've drunk the Starfleet Kool-Aid, you have. What about the poor McKee?
I mean, personally, if I didn't approve of an international treaty, I wouldn't start a terrorist organisation. That's just me. I personally wouldn't start a terrorist organisation with a very little plan, organisation, or real ability to sway influence.
Oh, yeah.
That's just me.
We're all our best friends. We take it a little bit personally.
Anyway. But I kind of like him in this episode because his vibe is very much, I am far, far too unqualified for anything that is happening today.
I am so unqualified, I'm going to turn to Rom. Unqualified I am.
Because the runabout just explodes and they all freak out. And there's a minute where it's just, I mean, it's like, oh no, everybody's dead. And then we cut immediately to postgraduate Professor Garak in his turtle. Which is amazing.
Wearing a lovely outfit.
It's gorgeous. I mean, I dress like that normally, so I can't talk.
What's particularly distressing about that outfit is that it's so reminiscent of the costume that Inabra and Tane wears. So he's kind of put it on. He's got, I've turned into my father. So that has just hit me then in a horrible moment of seeing. You watch these episodes so many times and they just keep on giving the same colours. It's the
whole. I thought we were exploring Julian's psyche.
My favourite, I mean, that great bit in there is when Garrick's like, I don't like the collar. And Julian's like, shut up, you look good.
I think you're great.
There are so many husband moments in this, I'll say. But I like that first moment of satisfaction we get from Garak is that when he drives that woman away initially, it's like, mm-hmm. Oh no, she's gone.
What could have happened?
What did I do?
What could have occurred? Oh no, was it me walking in? Surely not. Surely
oh well. I guess we'll have to go on this adventure together.
Together instead. Yeah, absolutely. So apparently he had that turtleneck had a 22-inch neck. They had to, obviously they had to specially make it. But
oh God, of course, because of the big Cardassian.
All the ridges.
And he's not even a Diplodocus like the other one, so. I wouldn't think.
Dippy Hydra.
Gosh, imagine a cat in a turtleneck. Oh, no, God.
I refuse to refer to him with his real name. I only ever call him Dippy Hydra now.
Dippy Hydra. That's excellent.
Yeah, it's full of husband moments. So there you
go.
They
wear
their lovely suits, and then they get changed, and they hang out in the flat together. And then a load of women try and interrupt with mixed effect.
I mean, that flat and them together have big Frasier energy.
With Tane in the chair as
like permanently fixated in a chair. Oh god. I want somebody now to draw an Abram Tane in Martin's chair from Frasier. If you are listening and you can draw, please do this.
Next to Bernie and his mittens.
So now we get the first appearance of Kira as the Russian agent, which Bashir is immediately like, okay, what the fuck?
Oh yeah, he thinks it's Garrick's little prank, which I'm not sure how even Garrick would have convinced Kira to have done that. Yeah.
And Garrick just assumes that Bashir wants to have sex with Kira.
Yeah, it's like,
well, why Garrick would want Kira anywhere near this program at all.
In her or anyone else.
Yeah, one of Julian's less insightful moments, I think. Well, obviously she's been completely brilliant in it. So that was the other thing I quite liked, sort of reading up on it again, how they, one of the no-nos was, we will not take a Holosuite malfunction episode, you know, do not pitch us that. And the guy came up with the story, pitched it as a transporter accident.
Iconic.
Yeah.
Oh, that works.
But it ends up in the Holosuite.
But it's just, as rules are broken.
And it was, I think it was one of the fastest cells they'd ever had. He kind of got the Holosuite past them. It's completely brilliant.
I do like the Kira character trying to figure out what they're talking about, and like Garrett gives away too much, and when she's like, what's he talking about? Julian just goes, he knows nothing.
Oh, and then he's cross, because that's the whole sticking point through the whole episode, isn't it? This is Garrick's expertise, and this should be a spy game, but he doesn't know the rules of the Bond setup. It's all getting beaten up by the Tal Shiar and dying in cheap hotel rooms, probably.
I think he's just so jealous of the glamour.
Yeah. So what? This never happened to me. Where's my beautiful flat? Where's my lifestyle?
I think a week after this, Garrick pulls out his spy who came in from the cold one and makes Julian do it. And Julian spends the whole thing sulking as Garrick, you know, happily sulks around, happily wanders around a library in West, a shabby library in West London.
Shoots people and they kind of hang over the Berlin Wall on barbed wire, and that. Yeah. Like, this is more like it. There's a great cartoon somebody did out there where Julian's kind of bouncing around, you know, spy games, they're so fantastic, and Garrick's going, it was all incredibly traumatic, it's not fun at all, it's awful and really miserable. But yeah, I wish they'd done a kind of Le Carre follow-up, a bit bleak.
But now we get, you know, so we have, you know, they figure out they need to find Professor Honey Bear. Also, that is Dax. And then O'Brien comes in. And Cole Meany's having fun here as well, isn't he?
He's wearing an eye patch, so he's having a great time.
Yeah.
And a leather jacket.
And we get action. An actual falcon on. Falcon.
Oh my God.
Falcon, that's how you say it.
But then there's a fight and we get action Garrick. I think this is like the only time we ever see Garrick beat anyone up.
He
beats a man to shit in a turtleneck. It's really weird.
Normally, Garrick's just putting himself in front of fists, isn't he? Garrick is just saying things to get himself punched. He gets a couple of punches onto Worf. I'll blank on the episode title. The one where he attempts genocide.
That could be any of them.
That could be a lot of episodes of DS9.
The one where I hate it when I can't remember episode titles. That the season closer where they go to the Founders Homeworld, and Odo's sick.
I wouldn't know the title.
Season
4 closer.
Yeah, we're all blanking on it. It'll come to one of us in a minute. Trying to fix the weapon system, whatever, and Worf tracks him down, and Worf kind of, pins him down, and Garrett gets off a couple of punches, which is pretty good going when you've been tailoring for 5 years, and this is Worf. It's kind of, you think, what are you, you must have some holosuite fighting regime. Yeah, but usually he's there to get punched, I think.
I mean, he does escalate a bit here. It's like they beat O'Brien's goons up, and then Garrick's like, yeah, you're going to have to kill O'Brien now. And Bashir's just like, what?
I don't know what energy Garrick is bringing to this episode. From the beginning, he wants to get rid of them.
Garrick woke up this morning and decided that murder was okay.
He chose violence. Well, that's every morning, but today that's he chose violence. Morning.
Yeah.
A very specific violence against familiar faces.
Yeah. And particularly Bashir, who is obviously stealing... once Keiko goes to Bajor, is obviously stealing Julian time that could be his Julian time, I think. And also for Keiko's sake, you would want to sort of rid the universe of Miles.
Hey. We will not, that is, Miles is the only good representation of Irishman ever because he's constantly tired and overworked. And nobody gives him enough credit.
Bullied by the show. That's
and get constantly bullied. Yeah. Do you want to join in the O'Brien bullying here?
Yes. I'm fine with it. No, poor O'Brien. I do feel sorry for Keiko. That's all.
We do get my other thing moment, which is when they pull over the panel of the holodeck and it's just a complete mess.
Yeah.
And like Eddington and Odo just looking at it like, is that a spatula?
Well, that's Quark's cost-cutting method, is it?
Yeah.
So there's no holodeck on DS9 that's made by or held by a reputable source. It's just Quark and his spatula worked holodeck, which is concerning to me, just as long run.
I do wonder though, because the way they talk about holodecks and how much energy they use and how much computing power they have, they must be really fucking expensive.
Yeah.
Is this like the equivalent of Quark owning like 6 augmented reality consoles or something?
Yeah, or a fleet of Lamborghinis or something. I don't know. But or was he stealing the power from?
That's another good
question.
There's
no way he should make that
power. How is he coping now that ore processing isn't processing anymore? Or it's probably all powered by Bajoran slave labor, wasn't it?
Yeah, like Quark's holodeck brought to you by slavery.
Yes. Well, yeah, wouldn't surprise me. But but what he's doing it from now, I've no idea. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That spatula. Maybe it's all that yamuk sauce he's got. He's found a way of converting that into
what does yamuk sauce taste like?
I need to know.
I have had conversations about this, and the conclusion I've come to is that what Bajoran food would probably taste like is like that time 2 days ago when I poured vinaigrette on ice cream. Which was horrible. It was really horrible, but that's what I think Bajoran food tastes like.
No,
it's probably good to Bajorans.
Bajoran food would be all fragrant and perfumed, and there'd be little sort of, floral decorations. And
why am I thinking Greek? Like Greek with a little extra spice.
I want to think very spicy. I still think it would taste like, at some point, some Bajoran food would taste like you poured vinaigrette on ice cream. And the Bajorans would love it, and nobody else would understand it.
All Cardassian food tastes faintly of fish.
I'm undecided as to whether Kanar is...
fish.
Is Kanar fish sauce, or is it as black licorice mixed with sardine oil?
Those are both horrifying.
Canars are sort of viscous.
It's so goopy.
Sweet booze, isn't it? It's like a really, really, like the at the end of a really long drinking session, it's the bottle of liqueur that you open going, this will be fine, I'm sure. In fact, it's almost more like at the end of a really long drinking session, the bottle of Night Nurse that you
have. It's Night Nurse mixed with rum.
This will be fine.
Kanara's the sort of thing that in Freshers, someone would have turned up with, and I'd be like, where'd you get that? And it's like, oh, I got it from an off license. And I just, that off license is closed. It's been closed for 3 weeks. When did you pick it out of Skip?
The bins or something. Yeah, yeah. But it would taste, there would be just the slightest hint of fish. No, I don't know. I imagine kind of seafood very, very, very spicy, actually, very sort of.
I don't think they take the time to spice up their food. I feel like it's either just gruel, like it's just not interesting. They haven't put any effort in.
Do you not think they've got like a competitive who can eat the hottest chili thing going on?
I feel like something Bajorans would do, to be honest. I think that's more of a Bajoran thing than a Cardassian. I feel like Cardassian food is only spicy because of the time they spent on Bajor. British Empire kind of way.
Who could, but your food would be who could say the longest prayer before just getting too hungry.
Only the pious enjoy.
Blink first.
Bajoran society is so weird. And this is a massive side comment, but now we're off track. I'm just going to say it. Which is that the Bajoran canon is so baffling that they have mentioned 5 different legislative councils across DS9 by 5 different names.
So they've got the Vedic Assembly.
That's your religious assembly.
Yeah, they've got a council of ministers.
There's a council of ministers, there's a chamber of ministers.
Oh, right.
Then there's a legislative assembly, and then there's 2 more.
Flipping heck.
Wow.
What are the other 2?
Either. I don't know. I think it's something like there is the government cabinet. And then, the Grand Assembly or something.
Oh, okay. Oh, you see, this is all a gift because you're going to have something which is like Congress, which is going to be both the Senate and the House of Representatives. Then you're going to have a Vedic Assembly. So you've got 3 names there. You've got the Vedic Assembly. And then the Grand Assembly will be the Vedics and the political ones all together. That's how I'd spin it.
I mean, I was just going to say there are 5. The Bajoran Constitution is just all the constitutions before the Cardassians. Mashed together. Yeah. And then nobody read it properly. So there are now 5 houses which will have conflicting powers and authority. And that's why no governing is done on Bajor.
Yeah. And they've got, and then it's complicated by the caste system. Yeah.
So we have no canon, coherent reason for that.
No.
Okay.
No. I mean,
they
sure.
Just each time.
A little bit like the British Constitution.
Yeah.
I'm sure my my friend, who is an esteemed Bajor expert, will probably comment something angrily about Bajoran culture.
Oh, right. I don't assume to have any kind of information about Bajoran political arrangements.
In the edit, we just have Margot shouting at us. We put that in here.
We are just, after he yelled, I'm thinking. But anyway, back to Bond films.
Oh, yeah.
We go to Paris and we get the best 60s music kit. I mean, it's not as good as the cover of the Star Trek theme I use for the podcast music, which is...
Nothing could exceed it.
Nothing could exceed it. But it's still pretty... It's like, this is aggressively 60s.
Yeah.
And then we get, we get the full Bond playing Baccarat, but with Worf. And I feel like this was an off day for Michael Dorn.
I agree. I don't feel they use him to his full potential, I have to say. I mean, I know they had a lot of people to write in. So, when you're writing in Rom and Eddington as well, someone's going to get a bit squeezed, and it's poor old Michael Dorn.
He's
not even doing an accent.
Yeah, imagine if Worf was doing a big French accent. Like, imagine that scene, if it had just been Worf doing a really bad French accent for the whole thing.
Maybe they tried that and he was so disheartened by that process, we are left with what we see on screen today.
A broken man.
Probably most of Michael Dorn's efforts is going to not corpsing when having to listen to the line, Baccarat and geology are my life.
Oh God, that's such a bad line.
It's a wonderful line. Really good.
Awesome line.
It's an absolutely fantastic line.
And then he pulls out a stun cigar.
Fantastic. Proper gadgets, yeah.
They wake up in what Garrick then calls another decorator's nightmare.
Yeah, Garrick's really, really on the decor. of this era.
He's not happy about that, is he?
Doesn't like the 60s. No.
I feel like Garrick is more of a 70s man.
Yeah. Bit more Persuaders and Jason King than... These shows mean nothing to you.
I know what the Persuaders is.
And, John knows all this stuff.
I know what the Persuaders is. I have watched an episode of the, I have watched Persuaders. It's... Okay, disclaimer, I may be legally 20, but I am in fact 44.
Yeah. Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. Much as John goes on about his youth, he will get all your references. So in a way, he's redeeming himself.
Don't worry. If I've seen the Persuaders.
Fire off a few, like Callan, the Sandbaggers. Is he on top of these?
Oh my God.
Yes.
Back to the episode. Okay, so it's discovered that the Cardassian sect has claimed responsibility for the attack, initial attack on Sisko and the crew. Mm. So the reason that they're in this weird Bond world. This happened, I thought that maybe it was a possibility that Garrick was so jealous and so enraged that he planned all of this. The transporter problem, it was all him. And, it was just, it got out of hand, and he realised that it got out of hand as soon as he stepped in that first moment. But, it wasn't him, so I'll forgive him.
Well, unless his scheme runs so deep that he invents a cover terrorist organisation too.
That is also a possibility.
I thought it was the Marquis.
No,
I thought him.
It's the True Way. It's a mention. Yeah. True Way, who are a sort of ultra-nationalist Cardassian group.
Thought it would have been cool if it had been the Marquis, though, especially with Eddington and stuff.
Yeah. They never really go back to the True Way. You feel like they're setting them up for something, but they never really go back. But that's fine, because that means I got to shove them in loads of books.
Yay!
Instead. It's one of those, you think, oh, this plot here that never got loose.
It's mine now. Or yours. But then we get, I think, genuinely the best part of the episode, which is Avery Brooks in a Nehru suit doing a Bond villain.
Yeah.
It's amazing. He's having so much fun.
Yeah. He has this strange, like, breathy cadence. I appreciated it, but I was like, what's going on here? He's out of breath.
It's great.
This side of snapping, isn't he?
I'm sure most of the references in this episode just go over my head. So,
how much Bond have you watched? Have you watched a lot of Bond?
My experience of Bond is me watching it as a child when my family were watching it, and experience in my adult life. I don't know.
I have a soft spot for Goldfinger just because it's kind of 60s punk. I have no soft spot for how overtly sexist it is, or the fact that James Bond is essentially, raping a lesbian. But, Goldfinger's bad, kids.
Yeah, there's a lot that's bad. OHMSS is... Oh, I've not watched Bond for a long time, really. It's not really my vibe.
The music is a lot better than everything else about Bond.
Yeah, and just the visuals of it, I think. But it's not something I've urgently felt the need to go back to.
I'd watched more Bond films if they just decided it was a 60s period piece.
Because
I think it would work better that way.
Yeah.
But, so stop trying to make it modern. It's like, it's set sort of randomly in the 1960s.
Yeah.
Because then, I don't know.
Yeah,
they get away with Bond being horrible to women.
I guess you could do Modesty Blaze instead.
Totally fine then.
I could just watch an episode of The Avengers and then, it would be even better.
I've seen that one.
You've seen that one. Olivia, have you seen The Avengers? Not the Tony Stark one.
The bowler hat one.
Okay, I haven't.
Dinah Rigg. Guy in the bowler hat. Oh, you're genuinely missing out on 60.
You're also
going over.
Yeah. And then the wall just comes up, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Because it's just the whole wall. I don't know. I just like the wall came up. It was very Bond villainy, and I didn't say I had the budget for it.
I they actually spend the money on this episode, don't they? I think they overrun on filming as well. So they're filming for like, I think they're filming for about 9 days instead of, say, filming. They're filming for 9 days instead of seven. So they really, really throw it at this one, I think. It's meant to be the big event. Of course, it probably means that what they have to do is the rest of the season, the kind of the TV equivalent of Bread and Water, which is the bottle show. We go, yeah. Oh, we'll just have an episode between O'Brien and Quark in a lift.
Oh, I guess O'Brien's stuck in an alien prison for another year.
Exactly. Exactly that.
Oh, well.
Oh, well, we'll give him 10 minutes to deal with his feelings.
Yeah, with his trauma.
And then he's got to go back to being a dad.
Yeah, exactly. Attempted genocide, 6 months, I'll be fine.
And then, yeah, so the wall is up. We have Dax and the dumbest, like, it's dumb, but like Bond villain level dumb, which is he's going to leak magma out of the earth to shrink the earth's crust.
There's so much in this that is just, it's like 5% plausible. Like, yeah. Even the idea of the transporter accident and these things happening, like, Star Trek, you're pushing it there slightly.
The best part is when Sisko, Hippocrates Noah, I mean, is explaining his plan. Garrick is just in a corner like, this is a joke, right? This is not, what the fuck is this? Yeah.
But also I think it's very important is the throughout, they're saying this throughout, the revealing glimpses we're getting into Julian's psyche. Yeah. Because when Julian goes into that, when people go into the holosuite, they're writing fan fiction, yeah?
Yeah.
And Julian goes in and writes a Bond pastiche where lovely women called Honey Burr throw themselves and the floor turns into lava. And when Garrick does it, he has Wayoon say, Ducasse is a preening fool.
I mean, listen, if I had a holodeck program, it would be me as an RAF officer beating up racist GIs. So I'd pay good money to beat white racist white GIs up every evening.
I'd be at Garrick's book club. Oh. I'd go into spy drama with him. He'd shoot me.
What would you do, Olivia?
I know what I would do. I would be a weekly lunch with Shran, Phlox, and Garrick, and just the four of us chatting and gabbing.
Would Shran have his pet snail and shit?
Do you know what I'd want? I'd want, I had a whole Twitter thread about this a while ago. I'd want their weekly box set night in front of the television. That's what I'd want.
With Garrick.
With Garrick and
Goggle
Jake.
Box with Garrick.
And Zial. Gogglebox with Garrick.
Exactly. Oh my God. I mean, someone's got to write that. Someone should write that for actually for him and Sadiq's live streams.
Well, you can find it on hashtag DS9 Gogglebox. We had a couple of nights.
Oh my God! I want to write a script and send it to them to do for their thing. They're watching like, I make them watch the Tinker Tailor film because I feel like Garrick would have thoughts.
Flashbacks, yeah.
Garrick having flashbacks watching Jim Prideaux get shot. Oh,
Yeah. Well, go and have a look at hashtag DS9 Gogglebox. You'll find something like that. But that's what I'd sit in. Or the knitting circle is the other thing I'd quite like. Garrick Stitch and Bitch every Wednesday night at the Celestial Cafe.
So, yeah, well, they're strapped to a laser in proper Bond fashion. And Garrick is just like, I can't believe my day is ending like this. I can't believe my day is ending with me.
I can't believe my life is ending like this.
So grumpy. I know that your life is at risk, but lighten up. You're in these situations all the time.
And then Garrick is just furious as Julian does his best Sean Connery impression.
Yeah. You see, I think that bit where he shoots him, I think Garrick feels like it's the first genuine demonstration of love.
I mean, that moment
is amazing, but you know what it overshadows? The DS9 Bond theme. I watched this episode, I went looking for it. No one has isolated that track. I want the DS9 Bond theme because it's better than the actual theme.
Yeah.
You know, I love Dax, I love the whole Dax thing because it's nonsense, and I love Garrick and Bashir falling in love because Bashir shot him.
And that's hot to him.
That is, he looks so like, marry me, so as he wipes blood.
No, this is like it's blatant. The nicest thing anyone has done to me since that fortnight with the Tel Shiar I spent.
I do like that we get when I do like the line as well. Kiss the girl, get the key. They never taught me that in the Obsidian
Order. Yeah, I dread to think what they taught you in the Obsidian Order. Good God, being shot is the best thing that's happened since my father made me ride on a creature that was too big for me. Those happy summer nights we spent.
Can we address Garrick's unbecoming quitter attitude? Yeah. Who would ever deign to be quitters here, right?
Here on I Quit Star Trek, we would never, of course, quit anything.
This is why Garrick quit Star Trek. I'm out of here.
He's just constantly talking about cutting their losses, and I'm suddenly seeing now the other side
of this man.
This well, is what this, we all feel
this
like.
This is why he survived, isn't it, I guess.
I mean, it's a good bit for Garrick. Like, I mean, this is also the, basically, obviously, whoever wrote this read a lot of Le Carre or Len Deaton or, you know, I'll even give him maybe some Tom Clancy about a push, because it's that same sort of thing they all like to Fleming, which is, this isn't what espionage is about.
Yeah.
And they are having, it's sort of, while they are homaging Bond, they're also having to go at the genre. Mm-hmm. Being like, you take your, this is a bit, it's farcical, you need to take yourself a bit more seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Garrick's the voice of that.
Yeah, I mean, Garrick is good at that, because it's the whole, he's just a foil for Bashir, but here he's a serious one. He's not just going, you're a ridiculous man. He's going, you don't understand what I do, it's just a game to you.
Yeah. But it isn't a game to Bashir because it's genuinely life and death for his friends, isn't it? So he's he shoots Garrick.
Like, as gratuitous as it is, I think he's enjoying perversely his friends being in mortal danger.
Oh God.
Yeah, and he's getting to be the one finally to save them and
my boyfriend's here to watch.
Watch me be the big hero and disprove his moral code and I prove my ethical stance to him. It's all extremely messed up.
It's so mean. Bit... He says, you're not a hero. He's a hero every day as a medical professional, Garrick. Thank you very much.
He literally flew into...
Clap for your heroes, Garrick.
To save your life, Garrick.
Why aren't you out every Thursday with your pot and pan, Garrick? Huh?
Next time your implant breaks down, I won't go single-handedly to meet Vladimir Putin save your life because I'm not a hero.
The other thing about shooting a Cardassian in the neck, I feel like there's something about that that's more than...
We're not going to kink shame on this podcast.
It just felt very specific.
No kink shaming on the podcast.
Yeah. He could have like did a warning shot anywhere else, but it was the neck and that's weird to me.
Could have winged him. Could have been on the thigh. No, in the ridges. Straight on the ridges. Ooh, that would hurt.
If it was Ducat, then that would be fun. But
yeah, I mean,
machine getting Ducat in the ridges.
And another one.
Oh no! I shot all of them off. I guess we'll have to do the ones lower now. Oh God.
Ooh. Sorry.
But then it's 2 minutes to save his friends. This is the culmination of the episode. Mm. And, you know, it's strange that this guy who wants to kill him so badly is giving him the time. I guess that is a part of the genre as well, the critique of the genre, that they have this time to have these indulgent conversations.
Yeah. There's always at a grandstanding.
Crux of the episode.
Yeah, there's a grandstanding moment and a big gloat. And then what should happen is that there's a ridiculous kind of action scene, and instead, Armand Bashir goes, no, I am converted to your cause.
Yeah, I'm down for the cause. He says, he gives the you're right speech.
Yep.
And Sisko makes the most iconic sound he's ever made, even though it's not him, but he just goes, ha-ha, in the most high-pitched tone ever.
It's amazing.
And it's great.
But yeah, I only
really... Being classically trained does for you.
Yeah. I only realised in this playthrough, Bashir quotes Garrick. At Sisko. Mm. Like he says the thing Garrick says about morality and cutting your losses and knowing when to quit to Sisko. Garak's just like, that's my boyfriend.
Oh, yeah.
Like smiling at
him. Oh, I'm so proud. Oh, my hand has shaped you. Now you can fly free into the wider world.
And then, you know, he saves the day, they all beam out, and O'Brien immediately is like, what the feck have you done to my ship?
Yeah, I've got to clean this up now.
And they have to add a little bit of a problem for O'Brien, just...
Yeah, it's not a DS9 episode of O'Brien's life, it's not hell.
What have you done with my spatula?
He's like, goes to make his corby pass the next day, it's just like...
Yeah, exactly.
What?
His eggs, it's all messed up. I feel like there's loads of scenes we don't get. You know, there should be lunch with Garak and Bashir afterwards.
Yeah, the best part is that second date or the next date is secured immediately.
Yeah.
Is it a holodeck date?
Yeah, I do like the ending. It's a shame because the ending is like, I think Julie and Bashir's secret agent will return eventually. And then UBM called them and went, no. Julian Bashir's secret agent cannot return, otherwise we're suing you.
Yeah, exactly that.
Which is...
And I feel it's the last great Garak and Bashir episode as well.
Well,
yeah.
I think after this, Berman was basically like, you can't write them, they're too
gay. That was too gay, yeah. And then obviously you get Tane's deathbed scene, which is, you know...
I don't understand why this wasn't sufficient for parody. Why were they in so much legal trouble?
Well, it was just before GoldenEye came out. That's why, because like
still...
the Bond franchise was in the shitter before this, and if GoldenEye had flopped, it's quite likely that UBM might have sold the rights. But they were banking everything on GoldenEye being a success, and people were excited for a new Bond film, and this was sort of running on that hype. So they didn't want them. UBM was like, you can't use this because GoldenEye was a success. We're gonna make a bag of money off of it.
I'm looking at the fair use provisions of the US. I'm building a very defensive argument. There's no effect on bonds value,
trademarks, or because they're probably they pushing it with the thing. Is it just too much? But I would have thought it was it would fall under parody. What was the law in 1994? That's the other question as well.
Yeah, because I think a lot of the... Because it wouldn't have been under fair use on the internet. It would have been under...
No, the Copyright Act was 1976 in the US.
Okay, all right.
So I'm trying to... I don't know. Maybe I just didn't want to litigate. I mean, it does take quite a lot of effort.
I've often wondered about this and whether they were just politely asked not to do it again.
The DS9 companion... doesn't reveal the content of the letter MGM wrote, except to say, apparently MGM did not find imitation to be the sincerest form of flattery.
Right, okay.
Because they wanted to do more of these, like more and more. Let's have episodes of Bashir on the holodeck.
Maybe the letter was, maybe it was one of those letters that you get that you look at and you go, do you know what?
That's the only explanation. It's
probably not worth testing this.
So which year was this?
1990.
What season are we? Season
5?
So it's going to be 97?
90. It was, I've got here, production took place in October 1995.
Right, okay. Yeah.
So just before this, there's a case called Campbell and Acker Froese, which is 1994, which is like one of those prominent US copyright cases where a parody of Pretty Woman is taken by Two Live Crew. So... But the crux of it was that, like, a commercialised parody can still be fair use.
What? So if they'd gone to court on this, they'd have a Paramount would have won?
I'm just saying that they had a fine case.
All right.
It's not a... Yeah.
But who wants to go to court?
But they don't want
to
do that. They don't have the time for that.
Yeah, it's like... Star Trek never has any money, so...
Yeah. And given that we definitely can't do Julian Bashir secret agent dollies, then... We're unlikely to. But I actually think, I was watching this obviously last night, and you know, in our heads, I think we think, oh, I wish we'd had another half dozen of these. But I wonder, I think they did the story. I'm not sure they could have done another one. If they'd done a kind of the Carré-esque one, but then it would have been very in keeping.
I think the thing about a Le Carré-esque one was I think that Le Carré-esque stories in DS9 would work better just as a story.
Yeah, it's in the Pale Moonlight or Inquisition or Duet. And we get the 60s stuff with Vic Fontaine, which are effectively Bond stories, aren't they? They're just they're Ocean's 11 and that kind of thing.
One thing I've realised actually watching this is, which I then confirmed on the Memory Alpha, is that Bashir gets his hologram from a man called Felix. Bond's American colleague is Felix Leiter.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know what?
Maybe because I don't know about these things, it seems like a fairer case to me, and I'm extremely defensive. But okay. Like we're treading into a lot of amount and substantiality of the previous work here, so you maybe were a bit more less careful than I thought.
I think there's probably a lot more in it. and of course, all the jokes of those women's names originate with Pussy Galore from the Bond films. So you know, it's all of it is just there's you know. It
I
really
tried
is.
For you, Deep Space Nine, but you know, you pushed
you
it.
You were taking the piss.
It's I mean, you were. It's a great episode, and some of the trivia is sort of. It was one of those big shot ones everybody loved. I mean, you were right, Una, about the money. Winrich Kolb commented that a $50,000 set cost $75,000 because there was $25,000 of overtime and weekend work. And it took 9 days to film. It was the longest production of any episode of DS9 because of the elaborate stunts and the reshoots after a lot of takes. And there was apparently an incident where they did Dr. Noah's lair and then they realised that there was no snow on the mountains in the background. So they had to go back and do all the snow.
Yeah, because the Himalayas don't...
That's just
they're not famous for that thing will melt.
Where was the production assistant that day?
Yeah. But the music was also written specially. And they said, you know, it's fine, don't go crazy.
All the main cast except for Jake, plus Garrick, plus Rom,
plus Eddington.
Yeah. You know, so it's a massive, massive cast. Plus the stuntman at the start. So all the, I don't know what Jake's doing that day. Nog isn't in it, is he? So they're.
I mean, it'll be a bit contrived to find.
What I like is the idea that they're in the next holosuite along doing something completely different.
Does their holosuite also have all have like the command crew in it? Yeah. What if they're doing like?
It'd be brilliant. It's like
maybe them duplicated just in another program.
That's why it was taking up so much space. It's like Shaun of the Dead or something. Isn't
oh
it?
God. Fun fact, Alexander Siddig and Nana Visitor became romantically involved at the time this episode was filming.
Of course, the romantic settings. No.
Yeah.
It's a really fun episode.
Oh, it's great. It's absolutely great. It's right up there. And it doesn't, every time I watch it, it has a bit that, it has the Worf bit, I think, like we said, doesn't work very well. And there's just doesn't quite sparkle. Although it's got those great lines and the you know the gambling in the background. And I think the problem with that is that it's too that kind of scene in a Bond movie is always a massive kind of you know you'll have a big sweep over a massive casino, and they can't do that. What you've got is like a couple of blokes in a room.
It's the private room.
It looks like a casino at the back of a student's union in Freshers' Week.
Exactly, and it should always be like a massive Monte Carlo casino, and there would always be a huge stunt, you know, be swinging off chandeliers and a gag about an exploding cigar, and they just can't put that on screen.
It's also a bit of a filler scene. It's a scene they need to do to get Bashir to the Himalayas.
Yeah, and have something for Worf to do.
Yeah,
and to say Baccarat geology on my life.
It's when he says that Garrick's like, I can't believe you actually said that.
What is this world I'm in? But I'd love to work out Garrick's grudge match. What he takes him into as a kind of revenge.
The 15-hour first volume of the Neverending Sacrifice.
Yeah. Or suffer. You know, the exploits of Gull Tedious or something. Mm. But there would be a grudge match. There'd be a revenge, I think.
I do think the point about it being a development of Bashir's character is very good, because I think this is now our third Bashir character development episode.
Third?
Because we did all the way one where he turned 30.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
we did Dr. Bashir, I presume. So yeah.
That's Dr. Bashir, I presume, isn't that season
that's later.
Five? Yeah, that's yeah. after the Tane father reveals. So that's season five. Mm. And the implant, turning out that he's a that one. And then turning out that he was a changeling.
That's a great story. I genuinely think that's great, because it also really works, because obviously they only didn't think about it beforehand.
Mm.
So it's not like they left any hints in all the previous episodes. It's just like, wait, what?
Hey, hang on.
Which I think is better than like the sort of Battlestar Galactica approach where it's hinted at all the way through.
Because doing it's just over a bit... the uniform change is the stroke of genius, I think.
Yeah.
He's in the wrong uniform. But springing the genetic enhancements on everyone is a bit of a cheek. But yeah, it's a great twist. Many things in DS9, you go, oh, I wish I could have had more of it. You know?
It's the sort of thing you get that the books are for. And there's a nice casual, very competent segue here into the question. What is it actually like, writing Trek books? Because I presume it's different to fan fiction, you can do what you want. How does that work? You just pull a stack of episodes to try and get, how does it work?
Well, procedurally, it's exactly right, writing fan fiction, which is that you sit and watch a load of episodes and then go, oh, I get to write these guys for fun. I guess fan fiction, you could do whatever you like. You can end on the kiss, or you can go further. You do go as far as you like. You can't necessarily do that with franchise fiction, because often you're having to put people back in the box. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're having to particularly if you're Sir Holomen, which is my follow-up to In the Pale Moonlight, that's literally stuck between two episodes. So there's quite rigid things that you can do with it. You couldn't change character development in certain ways.
How do you know the boundaries? Like, how does that work from even an IP perspective? You just get a list that's like, do not mess with this at all.
Well, I know that I can't. So if I'm writing an episode that follows up In the Pale Moonlight and, comes before his way, I know I can't kill any of the main characters. It's as simple as that.
Can't kill the cat?
Well, not for want of trying. I had to bring him back at the end of it, but it would be like writing with the show. You wouldn't, and on the show as well, there are things they decided not to do. So didn't the Wire start out? They were going to have it with Kira being being a drug addict, and then they went, actually, no, we can't do that with a lead, because it's something we would have to come back to with that character again and again and again. So series TV is, by its nature, constrained in this sort of way, or something with a soapy element. Something like the Picard book, we knew that it was a prequel novel, so we knew that we had to get Picard from here, which was being in Starfleet, to here, which was not being in Starfleet.
And presumably you had some access, of course, to the writer's room to be like, because, part of him leaving is a scene. So presumably you knew about that scene before you sat down and wrote it.
Yeah, I had access to the scripts while I was writing the book. So
what about the Tilly book? Because I know that came out between seasons, if I remember correctly.
It did, yeah. So I think I had access to. But we'd seen season one by then, hadn't we?
Yeah.
I think, yeah. We'd seen season one, and I think season two was just starting, but I can't quite remember now. I might have seen a couple of early scripts, because I think it was just where the book writing fell. Mm. But the Picard one, I was in the loop of getting the script, which obviously you had to be. And it's very, very weird, because obviously these things are covered by non-disclosure agreements, and you can't even say the word Picard. I was unhappy saying words like pickle, And then and it's the same, I've done Doctor Who books as well. So I did one of the first batch for the Jodie Whittaker Doctor, and you've got massive NDAs around, because obviously any of this gets in the papers, it's a big sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then what this means is that when you watch the first episode, one of these comes out, it feels really transgressive. You're going, I don't think people should.
It's like, oh, wait, they're meant to.
Oh, yes, it's the premiere night. It's exactly when we're supposed to be. So it's quite an odd experience, because you've not necessarily seen the episode is the other thing. You might have seen a few rough cuts or a few minutes or something that they made available, so you can see character or something. But you've kind of read drafts of the script. You go, oh, can I remember this bit? Or that wasn't, it was absolutely not how I imagined this was going to be shot. So it's all very, yeah, it's really interesting. It's really cool.
There's like a convergence of nerd in me that's like, I'd love to write/see a Star Trek NDA.
Oh my fun. God.
This is like a part of me that's like, I'd love to see Ferengi labor contracts.
Yeah.
Because I'm the one.
Have one.
I'm the one writing a political history of the Federation Klingon Cold War, which I am really enjoying, but it's like, you know, I'm writing, why am I writing campaign speeches for a general election that hasn't, that it was entirely fictional? Well, like, why do I have a document on my computer telling me how Federation governments are voted on? But no one needs to know.
Somewhere on my computer, I have a timeline for the whole of Cardassian, the whole run of Deep Space Nine, a detailed kind of document of what's going on Cardassia and what all the
characters. I'll be honest, I would love to see that.
I've probably still got it somewhere. It's like a little, so it's how I plotted Neverending Sacrifice.
That's beautiful.
And it's all of that. It's the only way you could do it. You've got all these dimensions in all these different episodes, and you're kind of stringing story together from all, they said something about riots in Kulat City in that episode. Let me spin a chapter and a half.
Excellent.
There we go. We got some facts there.
It's like I spent a day figuring out how a don't method for Federation colonies and their vote for the Federation Council.
Yeah.
Like, why did I do that? I do a degree. I have essays to write. Why did I do that? This is what Trek does to us.
Outside of that.
This is literally what I was doing during my... So I was doing a PhD in sociology, and literally what I was doing was writing Deep Space Nine fan fiction. And then a man emailed me and offered me a contract.
So if I keep doing... What you're saying is if I keep...
I'm not saying...
If I keep writing this stuff, I will get a call from CBS.
I'm saying it happened to me.
But John, you need a call from the makers of She-Ra and Star Trek. And you need them to come together for you.
Oh, God, yes. No, let's not. Listen, all right. All I'm saying is that if you took the cast...
Try at that.
If you took the cast of Star Trek, the original series, and swapped them with the cast of She-Ra and the Princess of Power, both plots would go the exact same way.
Who's Kirk and Spock?
Katra and Adora, Katra, obviously.
Adora, okay. That's absolutely clear.
Yeah, and
Listen, okay.
I'm like on season one.
Well, She-Ra, you're on season one.
My brother. Listen,
all I'm saying is that Adora would destroy her career to go to the Genesis planet for Katra on a heartbeat. And also Glimmer would have a fit when she found out Katra's soul was inside her.
Yeah. They're a very, very, very pure pairing, it has to be said. Yeah.
So every day, you know, Glimmer wakes up and says murder is okay. Is this going to get cut? I don't think so, because I'm editing this week.
It's proper good, She-Ra. I mean, I was ostensibly watching it with my kid, and then it was like, yeah, you're going to bed. I'm just going to carry on with this.
Plus his replay on Princess Prom.
Yeah, it's proper good.
So yeah, you haven't watched it yet, Olivia, which is, I'm upset about.
I'm on season one. I don't know which episode I'm on because my brother makes me watch it.
Okay, Olivia's brother, sit her down and make her watch more.
Just get him.
Thank you.
Just binge the thing. It is very bingeable. It is very watchable.
It is very bingeable. I did it in 2 weeks.
I'll do it. I'll do it for you.
Thank you. And then Babylon 5.
Then Babylon 5. Yeah. Babylon 5 is less accessible.
Is She-Ra over Babylon 5?
Yeah, Babylon 5 is unfortunately not gay enough to have priority.
Yeah, that's probably...
You're down already.
Yeah, well, it's Londo and Jakar, I guess.
I feel like that becomes a lot less acceptable after the genocide.
Yeah, there is.
There's always a genocide getting into the way of our gay ship.
Fundamentally, that pairing becomes completely unacceptable after, you know, Londo does what he does.
Don't does what he does. Yeah. It's problematic.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, so we're not quitting this episode, are we? I mean,
no, I'm back next week. I'm definitely back next week.
No, there's no way to quit. You don't. This is not a quitting episode. It's dumb. you know, this podcast is about dumb episodes, but it's not a critic episode.
This is a beautiful episode that should
be. They have promised
me with reverence
hundreds more of these Bond pastiches. So
I can't wait for the next one.
Every week for these Bond pastiches. I'm tuning in for the episode where Garak and Bashir finally kiss, because that's clearly what this is all building towards.
Absolutely. I hope Rick Berman will gift us that as soon as possible.
I think it was around this time I tweeted, I'm, you know, on season four, right? I'm on season four of DS9. When do Garak and Julian get married?
Everyone was just like,
And everyone's like, and I was like, no, guys, please. This is happening.
I know there's a wedding episode in season six. It's got to be.
It's got
to
be there.
The thing is, and they're like, when he's in that little tuxedo, it looks like it could be a wedding scene. They're so close to each other. That could have been the I do moment in those first 5 seconds.
Now, Julian would have a meringue floaty gown.
Yeah. We could have had it all.
I'm
scared of what Cardassian wedding ceremonies are like.
Very, very long. Yeah.
I feel like at some point the father of the bride beats up the groom.
It would be grueling. It would just go on forever. Like all the rallies would be there giving a talk. You know, you'd all have about 20 minutes to fill. Oh God, endless, and legal contracts as well. Lots of property. Land rights, water rights, first edition transactions, it would be. Got
technically,
it.
You have to sign a family name copyright.
Pretty much. This is fair use. This is parody.
I don't think we can leave this week, which is a good thing.
You wouldn't dream of it.
We would not dream.
Consensus. Yeah.
We'll be back. Definitely.
We'll be back. And if our wonderful listeners would like to find more of you, you know, where can they find you?
Oh, they can come find me on Twitter, just being extremely bad-tempered about things, at Una McCormack, or else tweeting about Deep Space Nine, which is all I've done in lockdown, pretty much. Watch Deep Space Nine and tweet about it and talk about it, and it's been lovely.
Noble action.
I'm partway through my rewatch at the moment, so we watched Heart of Stone last night, so we're on season three. Ooh. Yeah.
And if, you know, our listeners live under rocks, I will, of course, recommend all of your books because they're all amazing.
Thank you very much.
But hopefully they don't live under rocks and have some concept of what Star Trek is before they pick this podcast up. Otherwise, I'd be very worried as to why you got this far through the podcast.
Some of my innocent friends are listening to this podcast, I've been informed, and they don't.
My friends don't bother. My friends genuinely don't bother. They're like, John, you have a podcast. What's it about? Star Trek? No.
I told them not to.
And then I told them to. What episode did I tell them to start with?
What?
I think I sent a lot of Troyers.
Move along.
Oh,
can't start them with TOS. They'll never respect you again.
Way of the Warrior. Always start people with Way of the Warrior.
Mm. Yeah. That's the place to start. See, the trick here is, Liv, is my friends don't respect me. So I've already won. Anyway, I've been John.
I've been Olivia.
And I always have been and always will be Una.
And we'll see you all next week.
Bye
for now.
Bye-bye.